All right, and good afternoon, folks. Again, this is Kate Gordon calling from the Alzheimer's Demonstration Grant State's Technical Resource Center. And today's teleconference call is going to be focusing on bringing evidence-based caregiver interventions to our communities. Our highlights for today's call will be a discussion with Dr. Mary Middleman from the New York University, and as well as Lynn Cordy, who is our program manager for the Washington State Aging and Disability Services Administration, running one of our Alzheimer's Demonstration Grants to States program out in Washington State. Also joining us on the line should be Lori Stahlbaum. Lori,
yeah.
Would you like to say hello?
Hi, everybody.
And is Meredith joining you as well?
No, Meredith is on her way to a site visit.
Great. Also here in Washington, D.C. with me is Diane Bronstein from the Alzheimer's Demonstration Grant States program as well. We are now going to do a brief roll call of states. And the way we do this is just basically we're going to call out states in alphabetical order for having a current grant with the Alzheimer's Demonstration Grant States program. So if you could, somebody on your line, please unmute your line by pressing #6. And as we call your state, just say here, and that's sufficient for us. Alabama. Arizona. Arkansas. California. Colorado.
Here.
Connecticut. Delaware, District of Columbia, Florida, Idaho,
here.
Illinois, Indiana, Iowa,
here.
Kentucky, Indiana, Maryland, Michigan,
here.
Minnesota,
here, Dr. Anadias.
Okay, Missouri, Montana,
here.
Nebraska, Nevada,
here.
New Jersey. New Mexico.
Here.
New York. North Carolina. I take that. That's not a here. How about North Dakota? Puerto Rico, I heard you calling.
Yes, here.
Hello.
Rhode Island. How about Tennessee?
Here.
Texas?
Here.
Here.
Utah, we heard you on the line earlier.
Here.
Here.
Mm-hmm.
Vermont? Virginia? Washington State, we know we've got Lynn on the line.
Yep.
West Virginia? Anyone from West Virginia?
Oh, okay.
All right. Any other states that we missed that are on the line at this time?
Maine. We have three folks here from Maine.
Okay. Hi, this is Rick Green from AOA.
Hi, Rick.
Hi, Rick.
Hi.
And from Minnesota?
Got Minnesota.
Okay.
Anyone from the early alphabet, when we called, the #6 to unmute, we're looking for anyone from Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, and California. All right, folks, let's begin our call. Again, this is Kate Gordon. Our focus today, bringing evidence-based caregiver interventions to the community. And we're going to start off with a conversation with Dr. Mary Middleman, who is with the Department of Psychiatry at the New York University School of Medicine. For those of you who are familiar, most recently, Dr. Middleman had an article in Neurology in 2006 titled Improving Caregiver Well-Being Delays Nursing Home Placement of Patients with Alzheimer's Disease. Dr. Middleman, or Mary, why should ADDGS grantees focus their interventions for family members of people with dementia?
Because I think that the family members are a major source of care for the people with dementia, number one. And number two, because they are very much likely to be in need of support and care themselves, because caring for a person with dementia is a very long and difficult, sometimes referred to as career, that can take many years and is very difficult to do alone.
Could you talk to us about the goals of the New York University's caregiver intervention?
Well, we started in the mid-1980s, and at that time we had observed how difficult caregiving was, and we decided that we would have two interrelated goals. The first goal was to improve the well-being of the caregiver, and the second goal was to help that caregiver to keep his or her spouse, who was the patient, at home with them as long as was possible and was good for both the caregiver and the person with dementia.
So what was the unifying theme of your intervention?
I think we had several unifying themes. One of them came out of an ongoing discussion with counselors who, at the time that I got to NYU in 1985, were volunteers and helping people based on what they thought was clinically relevant. And I kept asking them what was the underlying theme, and they kept saying there is no theme. Every caregiver is different. And so finally I gave in and decided that that was the theme. Every caregiver is different. And what that means is that the intervention cannot be provided like a recipe for a cake, but rather has to be tailored to the needs of every caregiver. Also, it has to be available for a very long period of time because the illness lasts for a long time and its effects change over time.
And could you describe for the group, as you mentioned, this was really starting in the early 1990s. For those who are not familiar, can you talk specifically, I mean, this study went on for nearly two decades, correct?
Yes, we started in August of 1987. And we have funding through the end of August of 2007, so it's exactly 20 years. And we wrote the proposal in the mid-1980s and began enrolling people in the study in 1987. We enrolled 406 spouse caregivers over a 9.5-year period, and we randomly assigned them to either what we thought was the best available treatment or to our usual care, and compared them over repeated interviews for as long as they participated in the study, which for some of them was as long as 18 years.
That's amazing that you were able to keep caregivers in an intervention that long. Could you tell us more specifically about the design of the caregiver intervention?
Well, the intervention itself, when we first designed it, had three defined components. The first component was individual counseling for the primary caregiver, who in this case was always a spouse, a husband or wife of a person with dementia. The second component was family counseling, which included the primary caregiver and family members that he or she designated as important to participate. The third component, which was supposed to begin after the first follow-up, 4 months after they enrolled in the study, was participation in a support group that met weekly under the auspices of the Alzheimer's Association. And there are many such support groups in the New York metropolitan area, so we didn't ask the caregivers to come into NYU every week, but rather to join the support group most convenient to them. And then shortly after we started the study, it became clear that there was another component that was equally important that we had not defined at the outset, which was what we call ad hoc counseling. And what that means is that the caregiver or any family member was able to call a counselor, the counselor with whom they participated in the individual and family counseling sessions, for advice or help in an emergency or any other kind of support that they needed. And while this could sound like a very expensive part of the intervention, in fact it was not, because it was only used when people needed it and was very helpful to everybody, whether they actually used it or not, to know that there was a counselor who they had met who knew the family that they could call on in the future.
I want to take a short step back, Mary. When you were talking about persons with dementia, was a diagnosis required in order for people to enter into intervention?
Well, we asked that the person with dementia be diagnosed by a doctor, not necessarily at NYU, but by a doctor as having Alzheimer's disease, because we felt like the problems of taking care of people with other dementias might be different, and really we were experimenting and weren't sure that we would be able to handle them. But I'm not entirely sure right now that we should have been quite so restrictive. I think it's really important that the person have a kind of dementia that's chronic and begins in old age, but I think we probably could have used the same intervention for other dementias with the content somewhat different to reflect the difference in symptoms.
Could you talk to the group a little bit more about the specific area that you mentioned of the intervention of behavioral problems with the individual with Alzheimer's disease?
I think one of the most difficult things about Alzheimer's disease is that the symptoms change over time, and the behavior that you have to understand and interact with also changes over time. So that in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, the behaviors tend to be memory-related, asking the same question over and over again. In the middle stages of the disease, they can be more agitation-like, and may even include yelling, screaming, occasionally physical violence, pacing. And in the later stages, the behaviors there really are no difficult behaviors, except that the person needs help with every activity of daily living, such as bathing, toileting, eating. And one of the things that this intervention seems to have achieved is it seems to have vastly reduced, and rather quickly, the caregiver's reactions to the behaviors, I think because the caregivers understood that they came from a disease and were not purposeful and meant to hurt.
So part of the intervention itself was during the counseling sessions that the counselors described those situations to the caregivers?
Every counseling session was different and tailored to the needs of the family in the room, but if the family was having trouble coping with or understanding behavior, or sometimes would say, oh, he's doing that on purpose, or things like that, then the counselors did everything they could to help the family understand what might be causing the behavior and how best to interact with the person so that the behavior wouldn't be so troublesome to them or the person with dementia. That could include role play. It could include more instructional information. It depended on what the counselor thought the family was best able, how the counselor thought the family was best able to learn.
And what was the training like for those counselors, Mary?
It was different for most of the counselors today that work for me have social work degrees, but at the start there was one with a PhD, getting a PhD in psychology. There were several social workers, one with a degree in gerontology, one with a degree in counseling. I think it's important that people who are going to do this intervention understand Alzheimer's disease and be in a health care profession, but probably social work has the best training for that, but I think other healthcare professions can also do it.
And if you could mention your publication that helps people to understand this intervention better.
Oh, yeah. Well, whenever I gave talks, people would say, well, exactly what do you do and how do you do it? And since it was more than I could say in any amount of time I'd be allowed to be giving a talk, we decided to write a book about it. So we wrote a book for healthcare professionals. It's called Counseling the Alzheimer's Caregiver, a Resource for Healthcare Professionals. It was published in 2003 by AMA Press. And the authors are me, Cynthia Epstein, and Alicia Pierjala, and it is available online either on Amazon, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or directly from AMA Press. And any proceeds from the sales of the book go back into research to help more caregivers.
That's fantastic. What I'd like to do is take a few moments here, as Mary, you've described your intervention, in great detail. I'd like to open up the lines for a moment to ask if there are any questions at this point from our grantees. Again, #6 to unmute your line if you'd like to ask Dr. Middleman a question.
I have a question. This is Romaine from Maine speaking. The question I have is whether there is any kind of special, I think you already alluded to this, but did you bring those counselors together to kind of provide them with some training and some consistency in what they would be, did they know they were part of the research, I guess?
Oh, yeah. There were at any one time 4 counselors working on this project. We formally met weekly to discuss the problems they were having with specific cases and what was successful, what was less successful. And they also sit in the same room, so they interacted on a daily basis about the problems that they were facing. This was before we wrote the book, and people have already replicated this intervention in another study. And the way we've been doing it since is by using the book that I mentioned before and also weekly telephone conferences with people who are at NYU who've already implemented the intervention as necessary.
Do we have another call for Dr. Middleman? Okay, and as you folks know, I always have more questions.
I have a question.
Okay.
This is Pam in Idaho. How did you come in contact with the people who participated? How were they?
About half of them came through our, we have a federally funded Alzheimer's Center, and about half of them came through our Alzheimer's Center. So the person with dementia was being evaluated at our center. The other half came from various sources. The Alzheimer's Association referred people to us. The local physicians referred people to us occasionally. Other social service agencies that were providing services in the community to the elderly referred some people to us. And some of the people who participated referred other people to us because they enjoyed participating. One of the things that I found astonishing was that the people who were in the so-called control group actually themselves felt that they had gained enormous benefit from participating, and some of them actually referred people to the study as well.
Thank you.
And Mary, while many of the callers have read your article in Neurology, could you briefly summarize your results?
The first result the first thing that seems to happen when people participate in this intervention is that their satisfaction with their social support from their family and friends improves. So what seems to happen is that caregivers learn how to ask for help, what kind of help to ask, what kind of help is reasonable to ask for. Family members also learn what the caregiver wants and needs and try to figure out if that's something that they can actually do. Everybody learns what the illness is doing to the person with dementia and the caregiver, so that conflicts are reduced and positive support is increased. And somewhat later, maybe 8 months after starting the intervention, we saw a significant reduction in symptoms of depression, which is a major problem for caregivers of people with dementia. The symptoms of depression not only were reduced, especially in comparison to the control group, but they stayed less than the control group for more than 3 years afterwards. So despite the fact that the individual and family counseling, I'm not sure if I said this, were done in the first 4 months after people enrolled in the study, years later they were less depressed than the people in the control group. I think because the family support was not only improved but stayed improved. And I think that and the other thing that happened was that, which Kate alluded to earlier, that the reaction to the patient's symptoms was reduced markedly, and for as long as we were able to observe them, people were able to tolerate the symptoms of their relative, perhaps they understood them better. And in addition, not yet published, but in press, we found that there were effects on the caregiver's physical health as well. And all of these things combined, I think, is what made it possible for these caregivers to keep their husbands and wives at home with them so much longer.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
Did you find there was any difference between the research group and the control group in rates of institutionalization?
Much.
So there was delayed institutionalization in
that? Oh, yeah. The difference between the treatment and control group in the time to institutionalization on average was 557 days, which is a year and a half. I think that's an amazing amount of time to help people with an intervention that is relatively brief and relatively inexpensive.
This is Mark from Maine, Mark Richards. I have a question. Did in any of your research, did you measure or in any way any reluctance around seeking the mental health services? In other words, the whole stigma around seeking mental health services?
That's a very good question. We didn't position it as mental health services. Very few people turned us down when we offered this to them. We were offering it as counseling, not therapy, and we're offering it as a way, a very focused way to deal with the one situation, which was the caring for the person with dementia, as opposed to improving their mental health in general. And so everybody was, and in most cases, people were very glad to be able to get in a room with an expert counselor and talk about the problems they were facing dealing with dementia. And we tried very hard to keep the focus on that.
So it was almost more like a sort of individualized training.
Exactly.
That happened to be provided by a capable counselor, therapist.
Yeah, I think the reason I don't know, there's not really a good word to describe it, because training in some ways is better because it takes it away from the mental health stigma, but it was a very supportive training in that it wasn't the same as reading a manual or classroom training. It was much more individualized and focused on the needs. Many of them were actually emotional needs, but people generally came to us wanting information, were saying they wanted information, but were glad to accept the counseling.
Mary, in the recent Alzheimer's demonstration grants to states' applications, there's been an increased emphasis on evidence-based interventions that required applicants to review and use findings from the body of research on evidence-based service models and techniques. While the applicants were not expected to replicate research findings, what steps might a community-based group take to adapt successful research interventions such as yours back in the community?
One of the reasons I was really eager to be in on this call was because that is where I think my next step should be, is taking this research, which was proved effective in a university research clinic, and finding out how it had to be adapted to work in the community. And I think that the community agencies really have to collaborate with me in order to make this happen. I think every area is different, and the needs of the populations that we serve are different. One of the things that we've learned already with a pilot study to replicate this intervention in the Latino community is that for some communities, it's not possible to provide counseling unless you provide additional services as well, because people are in need of them. And another thing that we might do differently now is to include the person with dementia in the counseling, which we didn't do in the mid-80s, but now that dementia is being diagnosed so much earlier, it seems like it might be a good idea. I don't know what other ways in which the intervention would have to be tailored. I'm working with several community agencies right now and really having them take the lead in figuring out what the adaptation process might include. It's coming to mind as I'm talking, but another change that we've discussed with these community agencies is that they think it might be more difficult to get family members to participate after only one caregiver counseling session, and we thought maybe if we had two individual counseling sessions before the family sessions, they would be more willing to ask their families to come in. But I think it remains to be seen, and I would love to work with anyone who'd like to try it to find out how this intervention would best work in their community.
Middleman, my name's Ellen, and I'm in New Mexico, and I guess this would be outlined in your publication, but what you mentioned would be true, I know, for our Latino families, is that they're very willing to get the training approaches, you're calling it, you know, versus calling it counseling. But we find, unless we're also providing either respite that helps them get out of the home to do it, it's even better received if we can do in-home interventions, because the primary caregiver particularly is pretty well tied to the care.
Yes, we noticed that in our study as well. And in fact, about 40% of the time, the counselors went to the caregiver's homes.
Very good.
That was more convenient for them. And one of the biggest problems, especially spouse caregivers, is that they become isolated because they get stuck at home with the person with dementia.
Hello. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Dr. Ana Diaz. I'm in Minnesota. I work with the Black Nurse Program. Of course, I agree with the in-home services because I work with a Latino community, and I'll be really interested in helping you with as much as we can with that, because a lot of work has to be done in the Latino community. I know we're working hard on it, but it seems that I don't know. I think that I don't see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, I have an associate, Carolyn Rosenthal Gelman, who is a PhD social worker with a Latino background, despite her name, and she's the one who did the pilot study and found the need for that there was a really crying need for services and for knowledge in the Latino community, even more than in the rest of the American communities, where I think there's also a need for knowledge. But what she did this pilot study, and she found it very difficult to recruit participants, but she wasn't discouraged. What she did was she found a social service agency in a Latino area that provides services to Latino elderly, and they are going to work with her now so that they are already providing some other services, and they will recruit the people into this intervention.
Well, also let her know that I can also provide some of them, because we have a 65 elders that we take care of, and the majority of them has memory loss,
yeah,
and some of them has the Alzheimer's diagnosis done. Also, I'm working with Teresa Byrne, which is the creator of the CPT test, and actually I'm reviewing the translation for the CPT test, and we're going to do a pilot study on it. Before the call, we were sending each other's emails about it, and we will get together at one point. So that will be a really good deal on the CPT test, because as far as I know, not many Latinos has that done.
Sarah, this is Kate again. I know that we briefly just touched on the current project that you're working on in New York City. Could you talk about some of the other community groups that you're working with right now?
Well, we're working with several community groups to try to develop a proposal that hopefully will get funded in the near future to try to replicate the study in a community setting. One is with rural communities in northern Vermont, and they are working with the physicians, trying to help them to diagnose and understand dementia, and then they will hopefully enroll the people who are eligible into our study. Another is in Cape Cod, where there is a large, very large older adult population. And there also are many American Indians and many Portuguese, and we're going to be working with them to try to develop services that are appropriate there, using our intervention as the framework and tailoring it as necessary to that population. And the third is an organization that provides care, group medical plan in New York that provides care to Medicaid recipients, many of whom are immigrants from various countries, and we'll find out in what ways they need different care within the context of our original intervention. I think one of the things that makes the NYU intervention appealing is that the structure can be fixed while the content can be changed and altered to fit the needs of each group.
And Mary, if you could just leave with some words of wisdom for us. If a grantee wanted to work with yourself or another evidence-based researcher to translate the interventions, what are some best practices you would say that they need to take in terms of process? How do you start working with a researcher like yourself?
Well, we've been meeting regularly on the telephone and occasionally in person, and I leave it to them to tell me what the needs of the community are, and the interaction is around what I can tell them about is the methodology that would be best used and how to test outcomes to see whether in fact they are being successful. I think it's a collaborative process, and that and can't be done without the major primary role of the community agency. And I think it has to be done very carefully and slowly so that people don't eagerly accept all my million outcome measures and spend 3 hours interviewing the caregiver, but rather select the ones that are most important, such as depression and perhaps understanding of behaviors or whatever they think is important to achieve, and work together with me to make sure that this could also be another evidence-based version of our intervention.
Great. And we have time before our next speaker for two more questions for Dr. Mendelman, if there's anybody on the line who has an additional question to ask.
This is John Selstead from Minnesota. And my question has to do with your main intervention and the connection with the medical providers for those folks in your intervention group. What kinds of provisions did you make or communications with the primary care physicians?
The primary care physicians sometimes referred people to us. And what we provide is really different from what they provide. So we encouraged, of course, we encouraged people to go back to their primary care physicians for medical care. And the counseling and support was something in addition, which we are hoping that medical doctors would recommend for the for any of the caregivers, caring families that are in their practice. And in fact, that's the reason why I had AMA Press publish our book, was because I didn't think doctors would have the time to do this, and I think it's really important that comprehensive care includes more than a prescription for medication, but also includes this kind of comprehensive support that we can provide with this intervention.
I fully agree. I was wondering more along the lines of issues coming up within the counseling or support group sessions that the physician could play a role in ameliorating, whether that's following non-pharmacologic interventions for behaviors, there might be a need for prescription. Was that all done through the caregiver themselves?
Yes. We have all kinds of HIPAA issues. So we would encourage the caregivers to talk to their doctors. We ourselves rarely, if ever, talk to the doctors directly.
Thank you.
Dr. Mendelman, this is Michelle Barclay in Minnesota. And could you just clarify for me and help my memory, how many sessions did people receive?
People received a total of 6 sessions. First, they had an individual counseling session, just the primary caregiver alone with the counselor. Then there were 4 family counseling sessions with the caregiver and the other family members and the counselor, one family at a time. And then the last session was, again, an individual counseling session with the caregiver and the counselor. But I think that one of the things that made this whole thing work was that the primary caregiver and the other family members were told that they had that they were free to call the counselor again for additional help and counseling as needed, mostly on the telephone. Occasionally, they would come in because they had come in for an evaluation or some other purpose, and they would request an additional session. But almost always, this was done on the telephone.
And Dr. Middleman, how many, what was the average size of the family intervention? Was it always, you know, one other family member, or was it often five, six other family members?
There were a lot of cultural and other differences in that. It entirely depended. Sometimes it was one. There was one family with three generations and a dog that came in. So it really depended on who the caregiver said was important to her or her. And we did not restrict the size. And we also didn't define who was in the family.
All right, folks, we've got some feedback on the line. If you could please press star 6 to mute your line. And we want to say a great thanks to Dr. Mary Middleman from the New York University School of Medicine. We're going to put Dr. Middleman's contact information out on the listserv, so if you have future questions or further questions for Dr. Middleman, you'll be able to send those directly to her. Our next speaker, thank you, Mary. If you could please press star 6 to mute your line. We have a significant feedback on the line right now.
Yes, please.
We're still hearing some significant feedback on the line. If everybody could please press star 6 to mute their line. Except for Lynn Cordy, who now joins us as our next speaker. Lynn is the program manager from the Washington State Aging and Disability Services Administration and works directly as the program director for an Alzheimer's demonstration grant to state's program. And Lynn, Washington State's current ADDGS grant includes a model of family caregiving counseling for families caring for persons with dementia. Could you tell us why Washington State chose this type of intervention?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. We are very thrilled to be working with our Dementia Partnerships Project doing this type of intervention. And I guess I just want to go back and talk a little bit about how we got here, because we have had a statewide respite program since about 1989, and then we had our statewide family caregiver support program, which started a year before the national program. As a result of that development, then we had the state program and then the national coming in. We were actually starting down the road to doing some general family caregiver counseling through the family caregiver support program. So this had been happening for a couple years, and one of the things that we noticed with our AAAs, and I'm not sure if every state is different in this way, but one of our challenges is when we define a program at the state level and it goes to be implemented by the area agencies, depending on the needs and the resources and the issues in the area, AAAs can decide how they're going to frame and allocate money within the elements defined in that program. So what that means is, while we have 13 AAAs, and people could have done family caregiver counseling starting in about the year 2000, 2001, we have about 7 of our 13 AAAs who are doing some type of family caregiver counseling. We did have a certain level of experience with getting the model of counseling out there. So what was happening at the time when we were going to apply for our Alzheimer's demonstration grant was that we were hearing from our AAAs and family caregiver support programs that, you know, in some areas doing counseling was a little more difficult because you get a contract with somebody, but you don't have as many people to utilize that. There might be resistance to utilizing mental health counseling. So as a result, there are challenges in the community for implementing counseling. The other thing we were hearing is that there wasn't so much dementia-specific knowledge out in the communities. And I think one of the things about a state like ours is that we have some significant urban areas, but we also have quite a few rural areas. And the issues in terms of implementing services are very different in those areas. So when we got together a stakeholder group to talk about what we were going to do with our Alzheimer's demonstration grant, we included representatives from our different area agencies and family caregiver support programs, as well as advocates for the dementia and family caregiver issues. So during our stakeholder meeting, what was coming out was really that where we needed to go with our program, because we have family caregiver support program across the state, is that we needed to get more dementia-specific and dementia-capable in our interventions. We already have a structure, but we really don't have that sort of specialty type of services out there. But we really felt that within the structure we could start building that, so we didn't have a standalone dementia program, but something that would be available to utilize within our existing programs. So as our stakeholder group got together and talked about one of the big needs in terms of dementia-specific interventions, it is the exact need, as Mary was talking about, for that individualized education and support. Families, you know, they've heard of the Alzheimer's Association. Each family is very unique, and sometimes support groups work, sometimes they don't. Sometimes calling in for information on the phone works, sometimes it doesn't. Every situation is so unique that they really needed some help in getting from what the needs of their family were to all the resources that are available out there. And it really has to happen on an individualized level. So as our stakeholder group was talking, we started thinking about what is it that they actually need in that intervention. You know, some of the needs are more for the education, some are more for the ongoing support, some is for help with problem solving. Some truly need mental health counseling to deal with some of the extensive grief and loss, the depression, the stress of caregiving. So how do you design something that's going to fit everybody? You really can't. So you build a structure, as Mary said, with flexibility. You have a basic structure for what the intervention is going to look like, and then tweak it from within to meet the needs of that individual family. So we came to this thinking that counseling was basically a good thing, that we knew that we wanted to match it with an evidence-based intervention, which is where we started looking at the work of Mary Middleman and her group. It's something that I've been interested in a long time, and when the research started coming out and showing that there were some very positive outcomes, we were thrilled to be able to use this as sort of a structure for what we were going to do here, because it already has the evidence base. And it just goes down the same road that we were seeing in terms of the need for individualized approaches. So I would say that's how we came to it, is really that the need was emerging in our state at the same time that this evidence was coming out. And so the two coming together was just a great point for us to develop this intervention. And then as I'm going to go on, I just want to let you know that we decided that in implementing this intervention, we were going to take the basic approach of individualized education and counseling and develop it into sort of two very closely related but a little bit distinct interventions, one which we call dementia family support consultation and the other family caregiver counseling. And the reason we did this is because when you're working in the real world, and we have these diffuse needs of people in urban areas and people in more rural areas, not only do the needs of the caregivers vary significantly and change over time, but that the resource capacity for who can deliver this service is very different from one area to the next. As well, the sort of knowledge base about dementia varies, which affects the capacity to deliver the service. So we decided we were going to take an approach of consultation, counseling, one which is a little more educationally based and one which is a little more mental health based. Now they have 80% of the protocol is pretty much the same, that there are just some distinctions into who would be able to deliver the different types of consultation counseling.
So, Lynn, in your quest for consistency, how did your stakeholder group develop guidelines and protocols for the counseling services?
Well, what we did is when we were starting down this road, as I said, for our project, which is called the Dementia Partnerships Project, as we worked on which interventions we were going to do and to define the interventions, we were working with a fairly broad stakeholder group. We had people from the Alzheimer's Association. We also have an Alzheimer's Society in our state, so we have representatives from there. We have representatives from the University of Washington working with us. As well, we had some people who were already doing this similar type intervention. As I said, we had family caregiver counseling going in the state, and we had a counselor who'd been doing family caregiver counseling through our support program in Seattle, so she was part of our stakeholder group. We had two different people who were doing sort of different versions of dementia consultation out in the field, and as well, we had some representatives from the AAAs who were implementing this project or possibly going to be implementing this project. And so we got together to work with our stakeholder group a couple times. I think we had two full-day meetings and then some conversations on the phone and some written back-and-forth work to develop a protocol. So it was really a matter of people's ideas coming together, getting everybody's vision for what this could be, knowing the background on Mary Middleman's work and where that had gone, as well as what we had been doing in our own state, and then hashing out the sort of issues that you need to say in terms of a protocol. What is this intervention going to be for us in our state? And sort of coming up with an outline and what would be the sort of minimum expectations of this, and then what were the ways that we could support the intervention happening so that it stays fairly close to the model of consultation counseling that we had set out.
So could you share more with us the specifics about that consultation?
Yes, I could. I want to talk a little bit about the fact that we do have the two different types, and most of the issues, as I said, are the same. For example, both are based on the idea that it's a home-based intervention. We know that it's difficult for caregivers to get away. We know that there's, you know, often just the practical issues. Sometimes getting somewhere is just too overwhelming. So both are structured as home-based interventions. The way we did it within our dementia partnership project was that we were going to allow up to 10 hours of service when they come in. And then we are basically saying you could have, you know, the number of visits it takes to do what you need to do. Our initial authorization is for a 10-hour time period. It would be based on a goal-directed plan. We really want people to be looking at what their needs are and doing some sort of practical goal setting and going in the direction that meets the needs that they individually have as a primary caregiver in a family. Both of these interventions target the primary family caregiver at the outset and include family caregivers as needed down the line. When family issues we know are coming up or people need to be included for planning, dealing with educational issues, the family can be brought in as specified by the or as desired by the family caregiver. The other thing that's common is that in both of them, we have a very strong link to the Alzheimer's specific organization, either the Alzheimer's Society or the Alzheimer's Association. So there's an automatic sort of referral in there to that organization and support with support group attendance within the model. And we also have, through both, the opportunity for what we call follow-up counseling, which is similar to what Mary talked about as ad hoc counseling, where they could go through a round of visits, and then 6 months later a new behavior develops or an issue with the family or an issue with the caregiver, and they can call back so they don't have to start over with somebody new. They can just come back for help. I would say that what is different in the two different models is really what that sort of initial need and expertise that's required at the outset. And for an example, and the sort of basic need for the caregiver is education, planning, pulling in the family, getting some support and planning for the future. The consultation model would really fit for that. If we know at the outset that the family caregiver has some mental health issue, if they have significant depression, significant anxiety, we've come across a number of our caregivers who actually have chronic mental illness or some other thing, you know, substance abuse or issues that really require a sort of higher level of skill from a counselor. And so we have that built in, that if those indicators are there, that we would refer them directly into the what we're calling the family caregiver counseling. Now, this doesn't mean that they still wouldn't get the education, ongoing support, those other elements, because they would. It's just that we would start addressing that immediate need for intensive mental health first. One of the things that I think that we've learned from some of the research and what people are doing is
that feedback on the line. Sorry, Lynn.
Okay. If a caregiver is having significant issues with depression, a lot of other steps that they might need to take probably won't happen. So we want to make sure that the mental health needs get addressed and then also the consultation happens. So there's sort of a free flow between the two. If somebody comes in and is assessed as needing consultation and they start out, but that consultant says, whoa, I think, you know, they need a counselor, then we might just refer them and have them go through the course with a counselor, a mental health counselor instead. So that's really what they look like. They're structured very similar to Mary's in that, you know, they're focused on education, they're focused on the ongoing support, setting a goal and looking at behavior change and problem solving and increasing the level of family involvement and support.
So, Lynn, with the marked differences between the family caregiver consultation and the family caregiver counseling services, what is different about the individuals who are providing those consultation and counseling services, meaning from the professional standpoint?
Well, I would say that we did set up minimum qualifications, and I think this is one of the things that when you put a program out to sort of the field to do it, we weren't working within a construct of, like, one clinic where we could ensure that everybody would have a certain level of skill. So we did set out minimum qualifications for both. So for the dementia family support or caregiver consultation, what we said is that the person had to have a bachelor's degree in social work, psychology, gerontology, or equivalent, and at least 3 years of experience in working with individuals with dementia and their families. And a master's degree was preferred. And then for the counseling, we say the minimum would be to have a master's in social work, counseling, or related subjects, registered in the state, of course, and then at least 3 years of experience providing direct counseling services. And then we prefer counselors who have had some experience with solution-focused therapy, working with family caregivers, and a knowledge of dementia and family caregiving. So we set out these minimums to see if this was realistic in the community, because one of the things that we know is that as we get into some of our more rural areas, we may not have mental health counselors skilled in older adult needs. Some areas might not. So we wanted to be able to have an option where we might have some people who are skilled enough with dementia and family caregiving to provide the consultation and do a lot of the education support working towards the goals and the needs of the family caregivers, even if they're not a mental health consultant, that we could have that available as an option in a community.
And given those different skill levels, what tools for referral and or assessment were you using?
Well, I guess I have to go back and just say that within our project, we have created partnerships. So we already have sort of a structure in place for how referrals are going to happen. And in our project, we have an automatic group of referrals set up between our Alzheimer's-specific organization, the AAA Family Caregiver Support Program, and the day service provider we're working with in our project. And these people work really closely together, so they meet regularly and they talk about some of the referrals. They do some cross-training about what their services are. So I think that the main tool for referral is just knowledge and awareness out there in the community. And there is a screening tool and a referral tool where somebody has to go through the eligibility criteria. But I would actually say that the referral happens because people know that this is available through our project, and they know that it's a service that is going to be helpful. I mean, these are people you're sort of preaching to the choir out there, that once a person has gotten into any of these agencies, they can be referred really easily within that. I would say for assessment that we didn't want to say you had to use a certain form, because people get a little crazy when they, you know, are told to do that they have to do a precise form. What we did instead was to outline the elements that we felt were necessary to address in assessment. For example, and a lot of this, if you look at Mary's book, that the book that she's talking about, The Counseling the Alzheimer Caregiver, was an incredible resource for us. We were able to purchase that and use that as sort of a training tool and offer it to our consultants and caregivers. And there is some information in there on the kind of things you need to ask. But for our consultants, the sort of natural things that they need to do, and so we outlined in our protocol that an assessment would include the review of the caregiving context and the family system support network, the needs of the primary family caregiver, an assessment of the home environment, review of legal and financial issues, and the needs of the person with dementia in terms of their need for assistance and behavioral issues, and then their level of knowledge of dementia. Now, for counseling, what we would say a little different with that assessment is that they would actually do a screening for caregiver burden and strain. They would do a review of the caregiving context, of course, and the family system support, and an assessment of the caregiver's mental health and any substance abuse issues. So those are sort of extra things beyond what a consultant might do.
And specifically in your counseling model, which differs from the consultation model, you talked just briefly about being a solution-focused plan for the counseling service. Could you tell the group a little bit more about that solution-focused plan within the counseling services?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that has become a little more clear to me is that when somebody is trained as a mental health counselor out there is a certain level of knowledge and a body of knowledge that that they likely have. And one of those things that has emerged, I think, in the field is this solution-focused therapy, or some people call it brief therapy. And it's really the idea that you're going to focus on what the clients want to achieve through that therapy work, and not so much the problem that everybody else might see that made them seek help. You're really focusing on what is happening now and in the future. You're not doing, you know, psychotherapy going into the past. You're looking at what would they like to see changed. And that's why we use sort of a goal-directed model, because through this kind of discussion, the consultant or the counselor can work with the person to say, what are the issues that you would like to see changed and what would you like to see happen, and let's work on those. And, you know, if you want your family more involved, then let's figure out what are the things that are keeping the family from being involved and what would you like to see happen, and so then what do we need to do to get there? So solution-focused therapy really is something that comes from the mental health realm, and what it does with family caregivers is really allow you to focus in a brief way, because we're not really funding through this program kind of long-term psychotherapy, is we're really looking at what is the issue that we can help with, and how can we move you forward to have some better well-being, to have less depression, to have less anxiety, to have more social support that's going to help you have a better quality of life.
And what results have you guys seen in the first 2 years of your grant?
Well, you know, we don't really have an evaluation yet, so a lot of this is, you know, we don't know yet. I would say that the response from caregivers has been incredibly positive. One of the benefits of having what we call consultation and counseling is that for those sort of spouse caregivers, that there are a few still out there in that field who you know, are reluctant with the idea of counseling, but having the sort of option to say, you know, we have consultation, has really allowed sort of the foot in the door. And once they sort of hear what it's about, you know, they have no qualms with it, even if they wanted to go to counseling. But the consultation can certainly meet most of the needs of the people who come in, because it is, I think as Mary said, something that is sort of designed around the needs, meeting the needs of the person. And a lot of caregivers can get their head around that. What do I need to better care for the person that I am taking care of, and start with sort of the educational issues about dementia and behaviors and why they're doing what they're doing, and then working on to the whole idea of self-care and why caregivers need to be able to find time for themselves. And so then the next step is finding time for themselves and finding the services and support they need to be able to do that.
Great. We'd like to open up the floor for questions from your colleagues out in the field. Again, to unmute your line, it's #6 to ask a question of Lynn.
Hi, this is Lori. I just think it's really great to, Lynn, well, one, how you tied it back to Mary's work, and two, thinking about when you went in, knowing you were capturing sort of a moment in time and trying to give people the resources, as you said, to move forward. I thought that was a really positive and proactive way to sort of describe what you're doing, because sometimes we can be a bridge, sometimes we can be more, but sometimes when we're planning a program, we do have to realize that we are a bridge, not the support beam, as it were.
Yeah.
Lynn, this is Diane Bronstein.
Hello, Diane.
Hi, how are you doing? I have a question, which is, you know, you mentioned very clearly that sort of the resource ability to deliver, your resource delivery, with even within the program is very different, whether it be urban or rural. Could you just elaborate on that and maybe give an example of, you know, how it works in one place versus another?
Well, I can tell you that one of the things that we have found, because we wondered at the beginning if having these sort of two different, you know, sort of names of interventions was going to be confusing and whether it was going to be complicated. But I have since touched base with the people who are doing this. And one example is like out in the more rural area where we have a counselor who is working in one of the more rural areas. And I talked to him about that because he seems to be, he's sort of doing it all. He doesn't necessarily see the division between consultation and counseling, which isn't a problem for us. I mean, you know, we think it can happen either way, and that they're enough similar that they can happen. But in a rural area, a lot of times there aren't as many people out there. There aren't the providers. A lot of our rural areas wouldn't have an office that they can sort of see or go to that would be related to an Alzheimer's Association. Or an Alzheimer's society, there aren't as many resources out there. So the counselor is sort of it. They're the person that hears their story. They're the person that acknowledges what they are doing and what the needs that they have are. So I would say in a rural area, there tends to be a sort of a more of a huddling of the resource, maybe even into one person, if you have that one person in that area. Where in Seattle, we actually have both the consultation service and the counseling service sort of right there, and they could go to either, and they could be transferred back and forth. They can have access to a variety of day services. So the urban areas are more resource-rich, and they might have access to more more of the higher level practitioners. You know, a couple of our counselors are PhD level, but you're not going to probably find that in a rural area. So in a rural area, as we go to expand, it was very important for us to say, you know, we may not have that level of practitioner in a rural area, but we may have somebody who's very skilled with working with families and dementia who could provide the consultation level of counseling. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Are there any additional questions for Lynn?
I have a question. Again, this is from Maine, and we are, I think, somewhat similar to Washington in that we gave money to the Area Agencies on Aging to develop different models of counseling, just to try to test them out. I guess, but the question really relates to whether the role of private insurance. What we did was we funded a certain number of counseling sessions, and then some of them actually were encouraged to go to their own private insurance, and I wondered if anybody else had any experience with that to fund counseling.
Mm-hmm. I could say here in Washington, you know, I really don't know the answer to that question because within our program, I think people are pretty much getting what they need in terms of the context of getting the counseling and consultation they need within our program.
Did you say how many sessions they were eligible
for? Well, they were eligible for up to 10 hours, and we've had some go over, and that's because some people actually go under in their hours, and the area agencies, like if somebody only needs 3 or 4 visits or hours, then they're sort of left in their budget to go over for another person. So it's a little bit of a fluid thing. You know, if family caregivers come in, and, you know, if their needs get met within 3 to 4 visits, they know that they can call back in 6 months if they want, but that other money is still sitting there. So it's a little bit fluid. We started out with 10 because it was just the best guess we had from people's experience. And they can always be referred. I do know from the family caregiver counselor that works in Seattle, there are other sort of funding through mental health that if somebody needs longer-term counseling, they could be filtered into that system as well. But I don't know if it's private.
And Lynn, just one last question from here in Washington. As you're entering your third year of your grant, are there any plans to continue this counseling in the future?
Well, I can say that we're pretty excited about the response that we've gotten. I think we're feeling that this is a really good thing to continue. And we happen to be sitting on a real good place right now because we just got through our last legislative session an increase in our state family caregiver support program. In fact, it doubled the amount of money we have in that program. And so part of that is going to be going, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Rhonda Montgomery's work in doing a family caregiver protocol that helps to identify, to assess the needs, and to help caregivers prioritize what services they need. So we're working on this computerized protocol of assessment for family caregivers themselves. In conjunction with that, what we want to be able to ensure is that when needs are identified, there is a full array of services for family caregivers. So we're allowed to use some of the money that came through in that package to augment our family caregiver support program services. And since, as I said, we have 7 of our 13 AAAs doing family caregiver counseling, but since we want to make sure that the full package is available to people, what we're going to ask AAAs to do with this new money that comes up in July is that they need to augment their program services in areas where they don't have them. So, for example, if people aren't doing counseling right now, then they would need to do some type of family caregiver counseling. So we think we're at a good juncture right now. We have some models that have been working. We know that we have dementia-specific consultation and a model for family caregiving counseling through the Dementia Partnership Project that are available for them to use and to look at what we have done as sort of a starting point. They wouldn't be required to use that, but again, it's something that's already developed. So we feel like we're going to start sort of working family caregiver counseling and specifically some dementia-specific stuff into what is currently going on in some of our family caregiver support programs across the state. So we get to start doing that now. Our grant goes through next year. And again, one of the things we're pretty clear on is that the the AAAs that we're working with have found this a fairly positive, that the set of services we're providing are very positive, and we've gotten a good response. So we are looking right now at our agency requesting some monies from our legislature to continue this program, at least in the short term, and figure out where we're going to go with this program as we try to augment the elements that we have defined for dementia-specific services. So we're pretty excited. We think that a lot of the work that Mary Middleman did in terms of doing the evidence base for this has really helped us to move our program along. We've had a lot of good response for family caregivers in our state in general, and I think having this evidence base has really moved us forward and allowed us to argue for the fact that, you know, we might pay from a state level, if we're paying daycare 2 days a week for somebody to go, we might be paying $5,200 or in-home care $9,000 a year. Well, we can provide a consultation counseling intervention for maybe $1,000 a year if it's $100 an hour. I mean, you look at the small, it's a relatively small investment, but it has such long-term effects and good outcomes for caregivers, where we're allowing them to stay healthier, have better well-being, and at the same time actually delaying nursing home placement. So, you know, it's sort of a win-win for everybody, and we found that, you know, the evidence that we have through Mary Middleman's work has really helped us to make sense of that for people.
Okay, thank you, Lynn, so much for joining us today. Again, that was Lynn Cordy, the program manager from Washington State Aging and Disability Service Administration, and also a thanks once again to Dr. Mary Middleman from the Department of Psychiatry at New York University School of Medicine. This call has been recorded and will be available within the next 2 weeks on the Alzheimer's Demonstration Grants and States Program's website. We'll follow up this call with an email to the listserv with contact information for both Dr. Mary Middleman and for Lynn Cordy, along with a link to this recording. Thanks so much, folks. Have a great afternoon.
Take care, everybody.